the cash crunch, why increased numbers of Kiwis are worrying about money, and what you can do to save more of it. For that and everything else worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you listen to podcasts.
Warning. This episode contains references to suicide, mental health, and abuse, which may be distressing for some listeners. Help is available. See the show notes for details.
Hi, I'm Michael Wright, and welcome to The Long Read from Stuff. This week's story is called New Zealand's Baby Scoop Era. It's the culmination of two stories, actually, from Stuff's Auckland newsroom, which were written by reporter Paula Penfold, who joins me now. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Michael.
New Zealand's baby scoop era. What was that?
Yeah, even the terminology is kind of dark, isn't it?
Yeah.
It started post-war, late 1940s, and it continued in various forms through to the 1980s. But the predominant decades were probably the 60s and the 70s. And what it looked like was a society led by a state and church effort to, I think, penalise young unmarried mothers in a punitive way and take their babies off them and give them to parents who either couldn't conceive or who thought that they were doing the right thing by giving a home to a baby who was described to them as unwanted, even when that wasn't necessarily the case.
How did this sort of unfold? How did this sort of come to be known and exposed? How did it end, for a start? I'm assuming we don't still do this now, but how did that happen, and how did it come to be that we know that this happened now?
It's come to, there's been decades of campaigning for adoption law reform, and the campaign is still going on. There are still concerns about adoption legislation, and there has been efforts to get it changed repeatedly, and they've been unsuccessful in many respects. You'll know that, you know, legislation has changed so that now adoptions are open. And so, you know, the parties to the adoption can find out who the other party is, and they can make contact. And there have been many successful examples of there being successful relationships established. But the issue has been that the records are not available from the baby scoop era parties. They cannot access their information, and even when they have been able in some circumstances to find some of the information, the picture is incomplete. So it ended because it became apparent that this was just wrong.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That you just could not take babies off mothers who actually wanted to keep them, who felt coerced to giving up their babies, who were, they call it, one of the stories is titled The Primal Wound, because the research that's been done since about the effect on both parties of that separation is so profound and can carry on for generations.
Mm. Mm. Has there been any response or any follow-up to these stories?
I've had a lot of response. I've had a lot of, my inbox has been flooded with sadness, it's fair to say. Mm. You know, what I've looked at is just two examples, really, to try to tell some personal stories ahead of the release of the report of the Royal Commission into Abuse and Care. I was surprised after these stories were published at how many people said to me that they had no idea that this had ever been a part of our history, a dark part of our history. So that's useful, that it's been educational to some people. But what it also has done is kind of open up the floodgates, really, for people to contact me and tell me their own really, really sad stories. Also, some people have contacted me to say it's better now. The legislative changes that have been made since that era have improved the situation. There are many successful examples of adoptions now. One really positive note, just overnight I've had an email from Di Hill, who was the subject of the second story. After that story was published, I was contacted by a father and son genetic genealogist team whose work is for no fee to help people like this to find their family, to connect with their family. And I've just had an email from Di Hill overnight to say that the first successful step has been made. They've identified her father, or at least the circumstances of his birth, in Wales.
Wow.
So for the first time in her 69 years, she has some real clue as to who her father might have been.
That's great.
Yeah, she's feeling Yeah, she's feeling great about that. You know, the key theme in this is the quest for identity. Who am I?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what you don't know. And this is
she might have an
part of an answer. Yeah, the start of an answer.
Yeah.
Let's hear the rest of the story. Thanks, Paula. Two stories, like we said. And just a reminder, this story contains some references to suicide, sexual abuse, so take care. Here is Paula reading her story, New Zealand's Baby Scoop Era.
Unmarried 27-year-old Barbara Doherty gives birth to a healthy 4.3-kilo baby boy she names Jason. As the nurse takes him away, Barbara glimpses the top of his head, his dark hair. She asks the nurse to hand him to her. The nurse refuses. That night, with only a few staff on duty, Barbara makes her way to the nursery, planning to pick up her son, feed him, see the colour of his eyes, his skin, anything. Again, a nurse refuses and says, "You've given him up for adoption." The adoption report of the Department of Education's Child Welfare Division notes the baby's description: dark hair, neat features, big boy. And oddly, also the mother's: tall, slim girl, attractive, high cheekbones, good bone structure. And in the section marked Reasons for Desiring Adoption, in bold capitals, no desire. That's because, as Barbara Doherty explains, there was never any such conversation. When the social worker briefly visited, contractions had already begun. "We didn't discuss adoption at any point," she says. "I wanted to take my baby home." No matter. The report contradictorily records, "Wants baby to have benefits of home with two parents." Barbara Doherty is given pills, vitamins, she's told, and discharged the next day, sent home with more pills to take. Jason goes to his new family with a new birth certificate and a new name. Barbara doesn't even get to say goodbye. New Zealand wasn't alone in this cruel practice. From the late 1940s until the early 1980s, forced adoptions were widespread here and overseas. Nobody knows the numbers affected in Aotearoa. There is no official record nor count. But judging by figures in other countries, Barbara Doherty estimates as many as 100,000 families were impacted here. Children stolen from their mothers under a state knows best policy that assumed they would be better off in the homes of married couples unable to conceive. Elsewhere, governments have investigated and delivered apologies acknowledging how wrong it was. "You know the sorrow and suffering of forced adoption," then Prime Minister Julia Gillard told affected Australian families in 2013, after an inquiry had found as many as 250,000 mothers had their babies taken. "You were forced to endure the coercion and brutality of practices that were unethical, dishonest, and in many cases illegal," Gillard said. In 2023, Wales and Scotland also apologised. But international pressure for a separate, related inquiry remains. Those pills Barbara and other unmarried mothers were prescribed the world over were not vitamins at all. It was DES, known as Stilbestrol in New Zealand, a synthetic estrogen given to birth mothers to suppress their lactation, dry up their milk, when their babies were snatched away. In the decades since, DES has been linked to cancers and life-changing conditions not only in the mothers, but their children too. Breast and vaginal cancers, gynecological abnormalities and infertility for three generations so far. Scottish forced adoption campaigner Marion McMillan describes being made to take 16 tablets a day for almost a week after giving birth in a home. She says, "I'm now dying of cancer and it haunts me whether that drug had anything to do with my illness or whether my children were affected. This is no longer just about challenging the morality of society at that time." For New Zealand women given DES without consent, the issue is complicated by secrecy. Birth mothers' medical records disappeared, so they struggle to prove they were prescribed Silbestrol. There has been no systematic effort to establish exposure levels. Barbara Doherty, who is a former nurse herself with a long career in health, says complicit in the cruel forced adoptions experiment were not just the government and churches, but also the medical and nursing professions. Doherty has written to government after government asking for an inquiry. Organisations such as Adoption New Zealand have advocated relentlessly. They say an apology will demonstrate an understanding that adoption was a failed experiment. It will recognise the impacts on Māori adopted outside their iwi and culture, the impacts on mothers whose babies were taken from them, and the impacts on adopted people who became legal fictions and lost the right and ability to know their family and history. In 1996, the Commerce Committee, considering an adoption amendment bill, strongly recommended an urgent inquiry be undertaken into practices over the previous 50 years. None happened. In 2016, Maggie Wilkinson, whose daughter was taken from her against her will in 1964, petitioned Parliament for an inquiry. None happened. Instead, the ultimate invalidation of an historical human rights violation. The committee said, although we do not agree with many adoption practices from the 1950s to the 1980s, we note that these practices reflected the social values and attitudes of the time. Another round in 2019, when the Social Services Select Committee heard from Wilkinson and other submitters, still pushing for an inquiry in the hope of a government apology. In response, the government directed the issue to the Abuse and Care Royal Commission of Inquiry, which heard case after case of women sent to homes for unmarried mothers, the commission noting they were treated with contempt and subjected to physical, emotional and sexual abuse, then coerced or deceived into giving their babies up for adoption. But such was the scale of abuse the Commission was presented with, beyond what anyone had imagined, said Inquiry Chair Coral Shaw. Its final report was pushed back from June 2023 to March 2024. The Minister responsible for the Crown response to the Royal Commission, Erica Stanford, had no comment in advance of the release of that report. Barbara Doherty is sick of waiting. She says many of us are coming to the twilight of our years and still fighting to be heard. But like everything in that process of deceit and lies, we were told to go away and put it all behind us. I'm in my 80s now. I could be dead tomorrow. Most of us women in my age group are going to go to our graves, taking the lies and trauma and kidnapping of our babies with us, and nobody owning up to it. What they did to us was not just traumatic and cruel, it was illegal. It should never have happened. You can't blame her for being angry at having to wait. In 1995, Doherty received a letter from SIPS, now Oranga Tamariki, responding to her most recent search request. I am writing to let you know that we have been unsuccessful in contacting your son Jason, now known as Paul, the letter said. In the letter, Paul is scribbled out and replaced with a handwritten Sean, SIPS apparently unsure of his name, let alone his whereabouts. Unfortunately, we are unable to proceed any further, the letter concluded. There is a determination born from yearning, though. And so, finally, in 2019, in response to yet another search request, Barbara Doherty received a further letter from Oranga Tamariki, with some answers, just not the ones she wanted. The letter read, I am deeply sorry to tell you that Sean died in 2015, aged 42 years old, 4 years prior. Sean died in Australia, the letter continued, so unfortunately we are unable to access his death certificate and we do not know his cause of death. The agency's file fleshed out details Barbara Doherty had been denied for decades. His name was Sean Scanlon. He was married and had 3 children. One awful question remained, and now, knowing his name, Barbara and her family went online searching for the answer Oranga Tamariki didn't have. And there it was, Jason, Sean, had killed himself. An anguished death notice posted by the Australian police, where he'd served as a senior constable, read simply, "One day, we will understand." Of everything life had thrown at me, this was by far the most excruciating, Barbara recalls. I was totally inconsolable. In that way, grief has of delivering a double punch. The second blow arrived when Barbara learned what her son had grown up to believe, that she had chosen to adopt him out because she was an airline cabin attendant who wanted to travel. The ultimate rejection, the box of clothes, the special message she wrote to be given to him when he was old enough, never delivered. In a small ceremony with close whānau, Barbara Doherty farewelled the son she had never comforted, never fed, never known, reading words she'd written directly to him. "For 47 years, I've thought about our first meeting and what we would say to each other," she read. "All I have ever seen of you was that head of black curly hair. I was powerless in a social structure that determined unmarried mothers deserved to be punished. In the grand social plan of that time, you were, from that moment onwards, meant to be dead to me. Yet you were never dead to me. Every day I thought of you and just wanted an opportunity to hold you and tell you I loved you. Rest in peace, my darling Jason." March 5th, 2024 would have been his 52nd birthday.
Today on Newsable, why more Kiwis are worrying about money as unemployment rises. Plus, South Samoa is cracking down on its dengue fever outbreak and the little peanut butter that could. We have all the details about the Kiwi food brand teaming up with NASA and heading to space. For everything that's worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you get your podcasts.
The primal wound is such visceral terminology. The theory comes from American author Nancy Berrier, who wrote that adopted children will retain memories of the separation from their birth mothers with profound effects on their well-being. It's written all over the life of 69-year-old Di Hill. Hill was adopted out against her birth mother's wishes. It's taken a lifetime to piece together her story through eventually finding family members who could fill in the many, many gaps, but it's incomplete. She says, "Much of this journey has involved me wading through and unravelling a series of lies and deceit from the different parties, encountering red tape and brick walls, which has caused dead ends and indescribable frustrations." Hill warns her story is not pretty, but she doesn't want sympathy. "Please don't feel sorry for me," she says in her candid way, "but adoption and all it means is shit." With ongoing health problems, Hill wants to talk about it while she can. "I need to be brave and tell this shit as it is," she says, "so New Zealanders know we're not the sweet country we think we are." The logical place to begin is when Hill was a baby girl called Rosemary Henley. A young Jean Henley left post-war Britain for New Zealand, arriving in Christchurch, working at a print factory, later moving to Wellington where she met a man whose name remains unknown and got pregnant. It was 1954 and options were few. Hers was St Mary's Home for Unwed Mothers in Otahuhu, Auckland. Later family conversations record how every day she worked in the laundry and cleaned the floors and walls with a toothbrush, and that her mail in and out was destroyed. Just before the year ticked over to 1955, Rosemary was born. It was early in the baby scoop era, a decades-long program of forced state and church-facilitated adoptions. Henley was one of the fortunate mothers. Her refusal somehow succeeded. She found work as a nanny in exchange for board for herself and her child. Her employer recalled her as a really hard worker. Until she fell ill, It was myeloid leukemia. She was admitted to Green Lane Hospital, and baby Rosemary's life was about to change forever. The Anglican Church came and took me away, says Hill. An aunt would later recall the church having blamed Henley's leukemia on her having sinned and had an illegitimate child. With the mail destroyed and having had no contact for 2 years, Henley's UK family asked the Red Cross to locate her in New Zealand. On finding her in Green Lane Hospital, it organised to fly the young sick mother back to England for treatment. And the Red Cross had more news for her parents. They had a granddaughter. But by that stage, it was too late, says Hill. The adoption red tape was in place and I was not allowed to go to England. With Henley back home but gravely ill, her father was called into the hospital. She was expected to die anytime soon. Family members report what happened next. Distraught, her father mistakenly walked in front of a train and was killed. Henley died the next day, 6 weeks after she had arrived back in England. She was 26 years old. A double funeral was held. Father and daughter were buried together. Amid the loss, Henley's mother asked the Red Cross to keep trying to find her granddaughter so the baby could be sent to the UK to live with family. Instead, at 9 months old, Rosemary was adopted in a private arrangement facilitated by the Anglican Church and renamed Diane. It wasn't until she was 9 years old that her parents told her she was adopted and that her birth mother didn't want her and so left her in a home. Hill says, "I had to be a good girl because they had paid a lot of money for me, and if I was naughty, they would send me back to the orphanage. I was told very clearly that my adoption was not to be mentioned again, at all. I grew up being called a bastard and told constantly that the sins of my mother would send me to hell." When Hill was 5, a baby sister was born, on and off for the next few years so they could have a break from me, Hill said. She would be sent to stay with her paternal grandparents. She made the following allegations about her time there during 3 hours of testimony to the Royal Commission of Inquiry on Abuse and Care in 2022. She says, "While I was there, my grandfather regularly had sexual intercourse with me. I didn't know what was happening." She was sexually abused too by an uncle who told her, "You're adopted. I can do what I like." "I told no one any of this," she says. "I didn't have the language skills to describe what had happened, and I was terrified of being sent to an orphanage." Yet she did well at school, excelling academically and at sport, until one report fell slightly short of her usual results. That's when the beatings began. Hill says, "Most nights I was beaten. There was a stick in the dining room that was a yard long and had my name on it. Many a time I went to school black and blue with bruises. No matter what I did, it was wrong. I remember hating life, hating my birth mother, hating my adoptive parents. I wanted to die many a time." Worsening the trauma, she says, nobody from the Anglican Church, which had arranged her adoption, checked to see if she was okay. It wasn't until she was 32, with new legislation in place, that Hill could finally access her original birth certificate, and with it, vital detail, her name. She sent off letter after letter to people of the same surname in the area of England her mother had come from, eventually finding the aunt who was able to fill in some of the gaps, including a crucial fact. She was wanted by her mother, who had done everything in her power to keep her, to raise her as a single mother, find work to support them both, until cancer came and stole it all away. The fact that her mother had cared for her for 9 months was heartbreaking, and to this day causes me so much upset to think about the lies told to me by my parents and the church that I was unwanted, says Di Hill. Hill still had only half the story though. The birth certificate did not name her father. She says, "Abandonment has played a big part of my life. No one looked like or acted like me. I was taller and broader than anyone in my adopted family, had completely different looks and interests. Looking back, I can understand it caused depression, much loneliness and sadness." Hill has tried DNA and ancestry websites in the search for her father. At 69, her quest feels more urgent. She wants to know his medical history so she can pass it on to her children. Setting out her life story to the Abuse and Care Royal Commission was harrowing. "We opened up the boxes of our lives," Hill says. "We lanced the boil and the pus came out. But nobody had any Dettol and nobody had a plaster to help us heal." She believes the Anglican Church has that power to unlock the key to the other half of her story, her father's name. "I want full access to all my records, unredacted. We all have a right to know from the day we are born who we are and where we are from," she says. "Each time I contacted them, the records were either burnt or flooded. Which was it? Is it even true?" The Anglican Church also participated in the Royal Commission, but Hill has had no contact. Stuff's questions about her case have been referred to the Anglican Trust for Women and Children, but have so far been unanswered. There is much to ask about. St Mary's Home for Unwed Mothers and the Anglican Church were, in my opinion, evil institutions, says Hill. They messed with lives and with girls' heads. It is time for a full apology for myself, my mother, and my children. The ramifications of the decisions made, disregarding my mother's and grandparents' rights, have caused far-reaching destruction. This is an abridged version of Hill's story. She carries even more, and it too is not pretty. "People say I should write a book," Hill says. "But no, I can't. No one would read it. It's too tragic, sad, and traumatic. We cannot, just cannot, have any more children go through what we went through. It was criminal, cruel, unethical, and downright horrible."
That was New Zealand's Baby Scoop Era on The Long Read from Stuff, written and read by Paula Penfold and produced by Jen Black. This episode was edited by Connor Scott. If you listen via our website, you can hear this story and more like it on The Long Read podcast, available on all the usual platforms. If you follow the podcast, you'll get the latest episode automatically. Thanks for listening.
If you liked listening to this pod, help us make more like this. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.